And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour, and what a great show we have today. A couple of WorldNet Daily's finest are going to be joining us. In the second half of the hour, we'll have Bob Unruh, who's going to talk to us about the invasion of privacy that we all experience at airports with those nude scanners. But first up, a man who's written so many New York Times bestsellers, if we tried to list them, the show would be half over before we were finished, Jerome Corsi. He's here to talk to us today about his latest book, Bad Samaritans, the ACLU's Relentless Campaign to Erase Faith from the Public Square. Dr. Corsi, welcome back to the show.
Mark, it's great to be back with you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I wondered where you've been. I haven't heard from you in a while, and it's obvious you've been tucked away writing this book.
I've been writing this one and some more. I have got a couple other books that are going to occur later this year. I'll be published later this year.
Fantastic. Well, let's talk about the ACLU. Now, if we believe what the media wants us to believe about the ACLU and what the ACLU wants us to believe about the ACLU, this is a nonpartisan group that's just out there protecting all of our rights.
Well, nothing could be more farther from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The ACLU, founded in the 1920s, was created by some radical socialist and actually communist leaders who came to a decision. You know, this was during the during World War One, 1917. It started, and the founder, Roger Baldwin, was actually a draft dodger who was imprisoned at that time. The goal was to create an organization that would fight under the guise of protecting civil liberties, but would actually transform the country from a Judeo-Christian country where God, you know, to attack God and to attack the family so as to create the conditions to move the United States into a secular, materialistic society that would be susceptible to becoming socialist or communist. That was the goal originally. And Baldwin, 1928, he wrote a book called Liberty Under the Soviets. He went and did a two-month Potemkin village tour of the USSR, came back glowingly reporting how these ideal villages were so perfect. He put on the board of the ACLU people like Foster, William Z. Foster, who wrote in 1932 a book called Towards Soviet America. Open, committed communist Foster was. The only disagreement Foster and Baldwin ever had was that Foster was really a radically wanted to be out front with his tactics, and Baldwin liked the stealth methodology, which is where the ACLU developed, and that is to pretend to be out for civil rights, to pretend to be out for civil discourse, pretend to support the First Amendment even on free speech, but really have an underlying agenda to, in the name of defending these freedoms, to undermine them.
For example, you point out that freedom of religion in their perverted world is freedom from religion.
Precisely. And finally, I think the threshold, there were a couple threshold cases for the ACLU. 1947, Justice Hugo Black, who was a Ku Klux Klan member, former Ku Klux Klan, and had a great deal of disdain for the Catholic Church. He wrote into a Supreme Court decision, this Everson case, the phrase, a wall of separation between church and state, which occurs nowhere in the First Amendment and nowhere in the Constitution. It is simply a phrase that has that Thomas Jefferson used in a letter he wrote to the Danbury Baptist congregation.
Mm-hmm.
They were anti-federalists, and they were worried that the First Amendment meant that the federal government was going to come and close down the congregation. And Jefferson was trying to assure them, no, that the only concern the federal government had was the establishment of a state religion.
Correct.
Great Britain had established the Anglican Church. But that the Free Expression Clause was meant for the government to be involved to actively promote a forum for free expression of religion. Our founders never imagined that government would be removed from religion or neutral with regards to religion. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. I mean, George Washington took the oath of office for president on the steps of the Federal Building on Wall Street, and he walked to St. Paul's Church and prayed. He took the oath of office on a Bible, put the, inserted that the prayer was taken, this oath was taken under God, and he inserted that into the oath, even though the words are not in the Constitution, that those words have been used ever since by presidents. The Founding Fathers believed that we needed to have an active form of religion, that it was inherent, these were inalienable rights in the heart of man, and if we did not allow human beings to express, and especially Judeo-Christian faith, which is what they all adhered to, the Bible, Old and New Testament, that we would lose our freedom. That, the republic they were creating was only created for a God-fearing people. And we were warned by our Founding Fathers many times that if we ever lost our Judeo-Christian religion, we would lose, we would start on the road to tyranny. And I think that's what's happening.
Now, very quick, Dr. Corsi, let me literally play devil's advocate for a moment. Why couldn't a secular America preserve liberty as well as a faith-based America?
Well, because the values in a secular America typically tend to be relativistic values. In other words, if there isn't a natural law, an idea that there human beings are built a certain way where our behavior is required for moral life and for salvation, well, then any set of values could be imposed or mapped as the values that the state gives or takes away. This is what we see going on right now in the sexual liberation debate. The Bible clearly is opposed to homosexuality. And this has been a problem because the public relations effort behind same-sex marriage wants to interpret same-sex marriage as a freedom, a liberty, just like, racial equality is a civil liberty. And this can be done by a state that does not say that sex was predetermined by God to be sacred because it is involved with procreation of children. If sex is not going to, if that's not the primary purpose of sex, sex is just, have fun, go enjoy yourselves, well, then a set of values could be hypothecated that the state confers that reduces us very quickly to the worst excesses that were seen under paganism and antiquity. Those would be the set of values that would be secular values that we would have to live with. It would produce a very different kind of society.
I would
what
think,
the state gives, the state can take away, too, Mark. The state gives, the state can take away.
My question is, if we all suddenly acquiesced and gave in and said, okay, great, same-sex marriage, let's go for it, I have to wonder what they would want next. Like with the anti-gun nut, if you give them an inch, they take a mile. So what would be next after same-sex marriage if we all said, okay, fine, we'll give you that? And
the ACLU is already targeted. They've already telegraphed this. The ACLU is in court today, now, supporting pedophilia. They're representing defendants who are from the NAMBLA, the North American Man-Boy Love Association.
I have to just pause every time I hear the name of that organization. It is so disgusting. The Man-Boy Love Association. The idea that these people even exist and that they don't exist hiding under a rock somewhere but actually come out in the open is absolutely amazing to me. And if you allow me,
Mark, amigo, I want to comment on that because, look, the entire purpose of the ACLU and the, in these radical sexual movements, a public relations campaign was run for a long time by the far left to desensitize people to homosexuality. When you go back to the 1950s, people had the same reaction to homosexuality, to men making love, that they do today to pedophilia. And so the expectation of the radical sexual groups and the ACLU is that you desensitize the population by presenting these, divergent sexual practices in terms of, well, these are just two men that love each other. And you present the emotional side of it. The two women love each other.
What was Michelle Obama's
puppies love each other. Do you want to separate these two puppies?
Well, what was it? What's the latest talking point on behalf of the left? Even Michelle Obama's using it. No one should tell you who to love.
Well, and also, I mean, the point on the, I'll send you a ton of ancient literature. I mean, I studied Greek philosophy and learned Greek when I was in high school under the Jesuits. The ancients argued at length that pedophilia was part of a boy's education.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Lots of I'll show you how the argument will be formed. I'll show you what they will say, because they did it in the ancient world.
Well, I can tell you this, Dr. Corsi. Law and Order a few years ago had an episode where a man was on trial for pedophilia, and he was pointing out that not that long ago, sex between two people of the same sex was as unfavorably looked upon as this is looked upon now. And he made an argument even then. And then at the Occupy Wall Street things, they were all chanting, yes, we can have sex with animals. So to say they want to pervert America is an understatement, and they've got the ACLU backing them all the way, apparently.
What our founding fathers warned was, as soon as you abandon Judeo-Christian ethics, which, remember, the world has been down this before. We've been there before. In the ancient world, Jesus Christ had no army. You know, the Christians were regularly taken out and thrown to animals in the Colosseums and crucified along the roads, and had to practice their religion in the catacombs dug underground. But yet, at the same time, the ancient world abandoned paganism in favor of Christianity, in favor of the lifestyle. And I encourage you to go look at gay rights activists, what kinds of, you know, take a look at a book, After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 1990s. You know, they were writing, it's time to learn from Madison Avenue and roll out the big guns. Gays must launch a large-scale campaign, you know, to reach straight through the mainstream media. So everybody thinks these shows like Grace and Will and all this stuff were, this was all part of a coordinated campaign beginning in the 1970s and 1980s, when gays recognized that they needed to run a public relations campaign and desensitize the majority community so that these aberrant, then considered aberrant, forms of sexual behavior were considered, oh, these two men just love each other, these two puppies, these two kittens, would you separate them? It would be heartbreaking, wouldn't it? I mean, and so forgetting what the behaviors are, that same logic could be applied to bestiality. I mean, how about snuff films where someone's killed, but it's done with an intent to create sexual excitement? Sadomasochism. I'll show you, you know, human beings are capable of performing all kinds of sexual, you know, behavior that would normally in a Judeo-Christian culture be considered bizarre. But from the point of view of moral relativism, where you reach the point, like you used to say in the 1960s, oh, that's just a value judgment. In other words, anything you want to do, any values you want to form, are just as good an equivalent to anybody else's values. Well, you know, you could justify Hitler on that basis. He just wanted to kill a few Jews.
Wow.
I mean, you know, as soon as you lose the moral compass of Judeo-Christian beliefs, then you're justifying behavior that through the lens of Judeo-Christian beliefs would be seen as psychotic or abnormal. But in an expanded definition where same-sex marriage is going to be place, it's no longer abnormal behavior for two men to be in love. You are, in fact, engaging in hate crime to oppose them.
Does the ACLU primarily go after religion, or do they specifically go after our Judeo-Christian roots? For example, I know that there's some colleges in America that have put in the foot baths in the restrooms in response to requests from a particular religion, and I haven't heard about the ACLU going after that. Though as a Catholic, I have a feeling that if I organized a group of Catholic students and wanted to put holy water dispensers in the bathroom, the ACLU would have a problem with that.
Well, are they really? I discuss the cases with Islam and show how the ACLU, first of all, I think all religions were intended by the First Amendment to be able to be expressed in the public square, and Islam would be included.
Of course.
And I would expect that Islam would be a tolerant religion, because only tolerant religions can coexist in this kind of a environment that was envisioned by our founders as a robust field of expression for all religions. Now, what the ACLU has done is they have hypocritically supported Muslims in contexts where Jews and Christians would not be supported. including foot baths and headscarves and other issues, you know, where the ACLU would argue you could have a headscarf in a courtroom, but you couldn't have a Ten Commandments in the courtroom, where the ACLU would argue that a school, a college, could require incoming freshmen to write an essay on Islam, but they could not require that they write an essay on the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, that's been my take on the ACLU for a long time, that they're really not trying to, well, first of all, they're not trying to preserve freedom of religion. They're trying to preserve freedom from religion, just as you pointed out. And there are certain religions they like, and there are certain religions that they do not. What?
And Mark, it's specifically an attack on Judeo-Christian beliefs. It always was from the beginning. Because the stumbling point in Marxism has been not religion. Marxism doesn't care about Allah. Marxism cares about Judeo-Christian beliefs. That's the family that results from, families that result from Islam, not a problem to Marxism. Families that result from Judeo-Christian beliefs stand directly in the path of Marxism and block it. And that's why you see even these statements, it takes a village or a child is a collective.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, when you establish Marxism, you're establishing all property is collectively owned, all income can be redistributed, the concept of social justice, which is collectively derived. And, you know, when Roger Baldwin was taken to see the Potemkin villages, he was not taken to see the collective farms where Stalin imposed upon the nation a famine unseen in Russia to that point.
Well, yeah, they're always going to put their best foot forward, and that didn't stop with that particular visit. I mean, it hasn't been that long ago that they take American celebrities and so forth over to Russia, and they get to see what the Russians want them to see.
This, Mark, has been the core of communism. The communism around the world, in fact, today the socialists and communists in the United States who present themselves, usually as liberal Democrats or progressives today,
mm-hmm.
all you can't present to them the problems of Stalin and the millions that he killed, or all the other examples of communism all over the world, Mao Zedong, all the murders, all the famine, all the horrible results, because they all either deny those things happened or say that they were because communism wasn't rightly imposed. And they show you this idealized version of communism, which has never existed in the world. That's at the heart and soul. What I'm saying in this book, in The Bad Samaritan, is if we proceed down this path and continue at the accelerating path, the accelerating rate we're going, not only will Judeo-Christian faith be attacked, it will become a crime to adhere to Judeo-Christian beliefs unless you do it reading your Bible in the closet with a flashlight, because it will be seen as hate crimes when a leftist socialist agenda, the cultural relativism, takes over. And all these things that Judeo-Christian would describe as perversions or aberrations or problems would now be decided as, hey, those are those people's rights.
We have focused, and rightly so, on the attack on the Judeo-Christian roots of our country, but there's been more to this furtive communist takeover than just an attack on religion. You also mentioned in the book an attack on family. You quote Galzin from The Naked Communist, and something that five decades ago he predicted seems to be coming true now. Talk to us about some of the other goals.
A lot of this has to do with an attack on the family. See, what the communists decided in the 50s, remember the 50s?
I remember.
The heyday of McCarthy mm-hmm. rooting out communists in the United States. And there were a lot of communists, and McCarthy was not wrong. I mean, you know, even today, you'll see people argue that Alger Hiss was not a communist. We have the Berlin mm-hmm. papers. We have his communist. I met Alger Hiss. He lied to me that he wasn't a communist. Okay? And the communists in the 1950s decided the best route for them to go was to stop being communists. It's something Roger Baldwin did in the 1920s. And to instead become liberal Democrats with a small D. You know, so, and ultimately, to make the Democratic Party use their agenda and to, you know, adopt their platform. Now, what Skousen warned in the 50s is what's happened, and that is that the communists would go underground and that they would become liberal Democrats with the objectives to do things like take over the public schools, take over the teachers' unions, to penetrate the culture so that, you know, obscenity or pornography were considered to be rights. You know, these secret takeovers, and I can read them to you here in a minute, have in fact become, what the communist agenda has been, a stealth agenda in recent years. And that is something, again, people shouldn't be surprised at, because it was fully predicted. Let me just read you some of the, finding the page of the book here.
174.
174, right. Yeah, that's it. To, you know, get control of the schools, list them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda, soften the curriculum, get control of the teachers' associations, put the party line in textbooks, eliminate all laws concerning obscenity, calling them censorship, a violation of free speech. I mean, just go through this list. Break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity. Books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. Infiltrate the churches. You know, replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible. On and on. Discredit the Constitution, calling it inadequate, old-fashioned. Discredit the Founding Fathers. Call them selfish aristocrats. Discredit the family. Encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. Need to raise the children away from the influence of parents. I mean, these are things that all have been done. We're fighting this every day. And it was predicted in the 1950s that this is the route the communists would go. And today, it's even, you know, say, you'll be discredited, or people attempt to discredit you, talking as frankly as I am about the agenda, because you're not supposed to accuse anybody of being. It's politically incorrect to say somebody's a communist. They all deny being communist.
What was it,
Bill
Van
Ayer denies being communist. He's an educator.
What was it Van Jones said, that he would forego the title if he could achieve the same results?
They have all said this.
Yeah.
And that's been the recognition. The recognition has been that you could corrupt America from within by using this as liberal democratic in our culture. You know, Thomas Dewey, one of the, you know, again, one of the major secularizers in America, Dewey Decimal System, we all use it in the library.
Mm-hmm.
Public schools all created on a Dewey model. And, you know, again, these were part, going back to the 20s, the Scopes Monkey Trial, which I talk about in the book, an effort to elevate evolution as science, the future, rational, intelligent people, and to say that those who believed in God, like William Jennings Bryan, who defended the state and won the case, by the way,
mm-hmm.
in the Scopes Monkey Trial, was just, you know, a bumpkin, a stupid, uneducated. And that has been increasingly the effort by the ACLU and those who have opposed God in America, is to, you know, argue that the Bible's old, not relevant anymore. Pictures of Christ in his times are 2,000 years ago. What do they know? We've got television. We've got the Internet. We've got grace and will. We're much more educated. We're much more liberated.
Absolutely.
We're tolerant.
Yeah,
well, yeah,
tolerant.
And what?
No, I'm just laughing at the word tolerance. I mean, you know, if you support every type of perverted behavior known to man, you're not a pervert. You're just someone who's very tolerant. It sells
you're
well.
You're urbane. You're now sophisticated. You're intelligent. You're... You know, this is part of human evolution, these experiments, and who knows what the next stage will be.
People have often argued that the Holy Trinity of the Church of Progressive Secularism is global warming, abortion, and evolution, you know, maybe against a backdrop of atheism.
Don't forget euthanasia, because now the ACLU is arguing for euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
So Obamacare, you know, you're a baby boomer approaching retirement and getting a little bit old. The cost-effective analysis of the medical treatment you need indicates we're not going to give it to you, but...
Sure.
We do have this nice little euthanasia package. Why don't you just go away?
I saw the bell curve that Zeke Emanuel, the brother, Ezekiel Emanuel, who's a doctor, and the brother of Rahm Emanuel, used to show around, where life before the age of 3 was worthless and life after the age of 65 was worthless. And I saw a liberal Democrat doctor on one of the news networks, and she was saying, you know, we use something like 80 to 90% of our medical resources that we use in our life in the last 6 years of our life, and that's just not efficient to waste all those medical resources on someone who's going to die in a few years anyway.
And then they die. All this money. So why do we spend all that money? They were going to die anyway. Why don't they just die now?
what was it Tom Daschle said? Old people need to learn to grow old and die with dignity. Don't you know that when he's in the final years of his life, he's going to spend every penny he can for every procedure he can get to extend his life? But then again, these rules that they put out never really are meant to apply to them in the first place. So,
well, it's one of the underlying issues of communism. It's always hypocritical. The communist leadership never lives the way they preach. And it's been, in fact, since the Russian Revolution, communism has been for the other people. You know, it's a lie, and it's always been a lie. And the problem I'm trying to point out in Bad Samaritans is that we're going back to this. And look, the book argues, Mark, for the fact that God will wage a war against this, that there will be another day. In other words, I'm encouraging people to God fighting back phase of this discussion. Look at the groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom, the American Center for Law and Justice. I list a whole bunch of them and discuss their cases in the book. Where the ACLU shows up in court, we need to have an advocate for God show up in court as a lawyer. But ultimately, God fights back. I mean, I read the Bible. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I can't find a single people who poke their finger in God's eyes, turn their back on God, violate God's law, and they get rewarded.
Good point.
You know, the judgment of God, which has been in the Bible over and over and over again for civilizations that turn their back on God, or the removal of God's protection from societies, our society was created a Judeo-Christian ethic. It was unique. Our founding fathers said it was unique. Abraham Lincoln, you know, the one great last chance human beings to express these kinds of freedom, based upon the idea that freedoms were placed in our hearts by God, not by the state. And we are, with the ACLU and with these series of court cases, we're abandoning God so that, you know, every time we have a national tragedy or an incident, a terrorist incident of one kind or another, Benghazi, Boston Marathon, you name it, President Obama comes out and asks everybody to pray. I say, wait a minute, you know, how hypocritical is this? You certainly can't pray in the public square. You can't pray in the public school. You'll be arrested. So where are we going to pray?
Good question.
I'm saying to myself, you know, God must certainly, we call up in the middle of a disaster and say, God help us. I'm sure God's saying, where have you people been?
Dr. Corsi, we're almost out of time, but I think my listeners will be disappointed if I didn't ask, where are you on the birth certificate issue? Are any of these books coming up in the future going to involve Obama's eligibility?
I mean, I've written so much about this, and it made absolutely no impact on the presidential election. The voters who voted for Obama, I mean, I'll discuss it in future books, but I'm beating a dead horse. You know, he's not answered any of the questions that have been raised. All those questions remain outstanding. The historical record will probably demonstrate that he was born in Kenya and was an illegitimate president, but there's so many other issues to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Pursuing an issue that is a probably correct, but politically a dead horse. There's other things to do right now. And by the way, that doesn't mean I'm, you know, not equally intense on the argument about Obama's eligibility. It's just that there are appropriate times to really pursue the argument when you're going to make a difference, and there's times to pursue it when, you know, we're going to get completely marginalized and discredited. The same as I'm saying on this whole book on Bad Samaritans, we've got to fight this battle now. Because in a few heartbeats down the road, fighting this battle, you're going to go to prison. The churches are going to be closed down. Boy Scouts were going to have their tax-exempt status taken away because they don't let
homosexual scout leaders. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Very quickly, tell my listeners how they can get a copy of Bad Samaritans.
The book is available everywhere. WND Superstore, BarnesandNoble.com, in the bookstore in Barnes & Noble, bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com. And I wrote it with an urgency because, just like I wrote the book on Obama's eligibility, I'm trying to get people to pay attention to an issue that I think we're going to lose on. Just like the birth certificate, I tried to get them to pay attention to an issue that I think we're going to lose on. But I want these things. Many of my books have had the effort of, or impact of being a book I wrote in Iran, 2005. I wanted people in 2005 to pay attention to Iran, even though I thought it wasn't going to be listened to. Now we're today, and Iran is doing everything I said it would do. And again, on all these issues, birth certificate, bad Samaritan, the attack on Judeo-Christian beliefs, Iran. I still passionately am on each one of these issues, but I'm seeing things now that are coming in the future. I'm trying to warn people again about it.
The first time I interviewed you, I suggested that you should write a follow-up book on Obama Nation called I Told You So, because so many of your predictions came true. I hate to say this, but we are completely out of time. I've got to move on to my second guest, but it was a pleasure to talk with you again, and you are always welcome on this show, sir.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
My guest in the second half of the hour is Bob Unruh. He is a writer for WorldNet Daily, and he's here today to discuss the issue of airport security and how it has violated our personal rights. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today.
Oh, yeah, great. As I was saying off air, we've exchanged numerous emails over the last year, and it is great to finally talk to you in person and have you on the show. I think it's long overdue. Now, tell me, Bob, this issue of airport security, just one gigantic, massive invasion of personal rights.
Well, there are an awful lot of people who have that exact criticism, and the story that I wrote is an opportunity for people to respond, for people to sound off. It's a little bit of a complicated issue, but the bottom line is that the government is now accepting comments on the scanners, the body scanners, the invasive pat downs, and things like that, which has not happened up until this point.
I think in the past they just basically said that's the way it's going to be, and if you don't go along with it, as with the case of Texas, as you pointed out, stop air traffic to your state. So
yeah,
there really hasn't been much of a choice, and they really haven't been too prone to listening in the past.
Well, that was you've probably put your finger right on the pulse of what's going on. They just went ahead and did it. But you know, those government regulations will trip up everybody, even the government, once in a while. What happened in this scenario is that the TSA went ahead with these body imaging scanners, the alternative physical pat-downs and things like that. And what they did is they did not address the requirement that when you have new rules and regulations, you're required. The federal government requires itself to have a public comment period. They simply didn't do it. They said, we're going to go ahead. We're going to not bother with this public comment period. Well, one of the privacy advocacy organizations, Electronic Privacy Information Center, took them to court. The judge said now they have to follow the rules and regulations. Now, the procedures have already been implemented. The machines are already in and such like that. But they have to allow the public to comment on this. So that public comment period has been opened up. The story we have on our site has a link to that option for people to participate. The Epic Center has that link too. It's at www.regulations.gov. And what it is, it's really the opportunity for people to sound off on this particular issue.
How much time do they have?
The deadline has slipped my mind right now, but it's a couple weeks out yet.
Okay, so we still have time.
Yes.
Fantastic. Now, one of the things I find interesting is that we are spending a tremendous amount of money on this. I mean, we're spending, what, billions on these pat-downs and these very, very expensive nude body scanners?
Well, yeah, and just the staffing levels for the TSA it's hundreds of thousands of employees these days.
I find it interesting that we're patting down, as you point out in your article, four-year-olds. We're patting down, as we've heard in the past, 90-year-old Caucasian grandmothers. Why can't we save a little money by profiling the types of people who normally fly planes into a large building?
Well, that's a very good question, and you'll have to visit the politically correct side of the aisle to get a legitimate response, because I can't explain. It doesn't make sense as a consumer. As a reporter watching this, it seems logical to me that, and especially given all of the government reports that do profile people, you've reviewed the DHS report that says returning veterans and people with Ron Paul bumper stickers need to be watched. That is straight up profiling. Is exactly
Absolutely.
What that is. So when we have a legitimate database of the numbers of people who have committed violent acts, what common characteristics they share, we know that. Why don't we then go and pursue those types of people, those types of individuals. I mean, just look at the success of the Israeli airlines. They profile, they're successful in deterring terror, and it seems to me that that would be the most logical thing to do.
Let me say with great sincerity, if 9/11 were carried out by a bunch of middle-aged Caucasian males, okay, which I'm describing myself here, you can even add 10, 15 pounds of extra weight we shouldn't have, and that was the profile of the people who carried out 9/11, I personally would expect to be patted down in an airport, and I would go along with it with the idea of, I'm not mad at these people for patting me down and putting me in the bomb-sniffing machine and putting me in front of the nude scanner because people who look very much like me committed these crimes. I would have no problem with it whatsoever. I've been pulled aside randomly for the search. Ironically, I remember one time being pulled aside. It seems like I always get stopped at either LAX or the San Francisco airport. I don't know what it is about California. Maybe they just see Texas on my information and decide to go for me. But at any rate, and I put up no resistance whatsoever. It's like, okay, fine, pat me down. Okay, fine, search me. I've been through that. I've been put in the bomb sniffing machine, and I don't know, it was really a bizarre experience in the sense that the woman who was trying to explain to me that I needed to come with her really couldn't speak English, so they ended up trotting out somebody else who explained that I could, or that I had to go into the bomb sniffing machine. Have you ever had that experience, Bob, going into the bomb sniffing machine?
I have not. It's been an extended period since I've flown, so a lot of these changes, of course, they're continuing, but a lot of these changes had not been implemented the last time I was in the air.
Well, I can tell you, it's a really weird experience. You go into this cylinder-shaped glass booth, and so you get in there, and they put all these little puffs of air on you. You just feel this little puff, and it's happening simultaneously, and including some very private places. Just as I was starting to get into it, they shut off the machine. But the bottom line is that they picked me for no reason whatsoever, and I in no way fit the profile of the people. This was post 9/11, who go up in the air with the idea of using a plane as a weapon. So I don't know why they were wasting their time on me. I don't know why they waste their time on 4-year-olds, 6-year-olds. I frankly don't get it. It just seems to me that we're wasting resources. As big as the left is on sustainability and as big as they are about not wasting natural resources, you would think they wouldn't want to waste financial resources, which is what we're doing every time we pat down a 2-year-old, every time we pat down a 90-year-old grandmother. So, but my question is, do you really think sounding off is going to get anything done about this, Bob?
Well, the issue, with the Boston bombing and the Obama healthcare and Iran and North Korea pointing weapons, possibly nuclear weapons, at us and our allies. You know, sometimes this recedes from the level of attention, from the headlines. It's back on page 11 instead of page 1, but the issue remains. The privacy issue is still there. As a matter of fact, you mentioned Texas when we opened the conversation, because I reported at the time, and I updated in this roundup, that Texas was one of the states that had really taken a specific stand, and they proposed state legislation that would essentially subject TSA agents to any of the touching, assault, and other assorted laws that Texas has. Meaning, if I can't walk up to someone and do it to them on the street, then it's not legal for the TSA agent to do it to me in an airport. And of course, that brought the response that you referenced, that the federal government said we're going to slam the door on air travel, we're shut down air travel all through Texas. No airports will exist in Texas. So they backed off at that time. But what's interesting is since I wrote my article, the Texas legislature has now been reintroduced to the same legislation. The issue has come up all over again. They're going to be arguing it all over again. I'm sure that the federal government very probably will make the same kinds of statements and promises that if you do this, then we will respond like this. But the fact is, the state of Texas is considering something like that, and it shows that the issue has not gone away. It shows that the privacy issue still exists. There are still concerns about it. It has not been resolved. So, given that, then a flood of public comments might get Washington's attention. It might get them to say, you know, there's other technology, there are other procedures, there are other ways, we'd better investigate them.
Bob, if I read your piece correctly, Texas wasn't being completely unreasonable. They did allow, if there were probable cause in a situation, that those things could be done. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's pretty much a standard across the country. If a federal inspector has a legitimate reason to suspect me or you or anybody else of doing something wrong, that is probable cause. That allows them to ask the questions, even detain people. I mean, that's the essence of probable cause. If I suspect legitimately that someone is going to do something wrong, then my responsibility as a federal agent is to detain them so that they don't do it, so that other people aren't injured. And that's pretty much standard across the country.
And I don't think anybody would have a problem with that.
No. I mean, nobody wants to get into the air, be 30,000 feet over the top of Chicago, and find out there's a whacked person aboard who has in mind massive damage to everybody else around them. I mean, that just wouldn't make sense.
It would not. Clarify something for us. Now, I hear in some instances airports still have the full nude body scanner, which is really no different than if you were walking naked before them. And then I hear that they've modified these scanners with filters where you sort of see an outline of the body and any anomaly that might be a weapon, but you really don't get a detailed look at someone's private part or their breasts or whatever. What's the truth on that? How many of these airports are still using scanners that allow them to see almost as if they were looking at a person nude versus one that sort of does a general outline?
Well, I don't have numbers in front of me yet because as part of the security procedures and processes, a lot of that information is not public. I mean, you can't go to an airport and demand before you go through the security line, what kind of machine do you have and what kind of image? Can I see the image so that I know what I'm going through? The public doesn't have that access. But it is true that the federal government has started modifying the machines. Some of them have been changed, filtered, as you referenced already, so that it is a type of stick figure image. Some of them have not. There are some that are simply being replaced, and I think it's over the next, I think at the end of May is when they need to be replaced, and that was because they were the X-ray type emissions. Yeah. They were violating federal standards. They couldn't be modified to draw them back within the guidelines, so they're actually being replaced with other machines.
Gotcha.
So it's an ongoing process. You know, what existed a month ago is going to be slightly different today, and it's going to be slightly different a month from now.
Now, my personal view is I don't have that big a problem with the general outline. I don't think someone should be able to capture a nude photograph of me. Not that anyone would want it for any particular reason, but I just don't feel comfortable with it. What's your personal take on that? Are you okay with the more general stick outline, or do you think that's unreasonable as well?
Well, you know, if we can trust that it would be a stick outline, I think most people would be comfortable with it. The problem underlying all of this is the way they instituted the original plans, the original operations. In many cases, the federal government was not upfront with the traveling public, telling them what was going on, being upfront with the specifics. And I think that the general traveling public developed a level of, I'm not sure I believe you anymore, attitude, and that's going to be real hard to overcome at this point. And I think that's the crux.
You said in some cases people actually showed up nude or stripped down completely naked to protest this?
Oh, yeah. I'm in the Colorado area, and one of the cases was at the Denver airport. This guy was just incredibly frustrated with the whole procedure. So he took off all of his – in addition to his shoes, he took off the rest of his clothes, piled it in a little bin, and let it run through the X-ray machine. and of course that brings a repercussion too.
Yeah.
And he had a little chat with the local security officers and the local police for a little while to explain what was going on. Not sure of the outcome of that case. Generally, it's not more than a slap on the wrist. But the point, that's happened several times, several places. And in addition to that, there have been several places where people have stripped down as far as their underwear. And it's a protest. They're expressing their high level of frustration over what's going on. And, you know, that is, to me, that's an indicator that the procedures themselves should be reviewed to make sure that they're being reasonable, that people are being treated like humans they're being treated reasonably in all of the processes that go on.
I am particularly upset with the elderly being patted down and with very, very young screaming children being patted down. At this point in my life, I'm not a frequent flyer, but I have been. And I can tell you that when you're in a situation where you're flying all the time, I mean, there was a time I was flying in and out of Philadelphia so often that all the little cart vendors knew me by my first name. So that tells you that you're flying a little too much whenever everybody knows your first name. But at any rate, at that time, these procedures would have gotten on my nerves. At this time, I don't fly as much as I used to. I guess I could put up with it, but I could see where frequent flyers would get frustrated to the point of just saying, here are all my clothes, take them.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that bothers me, and you point this out in your article, is that they're supposed to take those images and then almost immediately destroy them. Yet we all know that the Internet is full of those images that have leaked out from various airports. So you kind of get the impression that at the end of the day, the boys are like, yeah, I got a really good one. Check this one out. And you feel that they're not following that procedure. And that, to me, is one of the more uncomfortable things about it. Are they really going to destroy the image? Or at the end of the day, are they going to be showing people that they think are really hot or really funny looking to fellow coworkers? Are they going to post it on the Internet? Because there are some cases of that happening.
Well, yeah. There have been anecdotal stories all over the Internet about that very issue. And, of course, you cite the evidence. Those images are on the Internet. If they were deleted immediately, how did they get on the Internet? And that's one of the gray areas that the TSA really needs to address and explain adequately to the public, because the public has some legitimate concerns. If I see evidence of something happening and somebody tells me it's not happening, what am I going to believe, my eyes or not? And that's the crux of that particular issue. Yeah, the other side of that coin is that when they have training, when they have review, when they have tests when they run drills to see whether the machines are detecting what they're supposed to, whether the machine operators, the security agents are able to track down something. You know, you've heard reports on those too. Well, the point is, if those images are deleted immediately, how can they go back and say that this was an image you should have noticed? I mean, to me, it doesn't track logically. If you're having a drill, someone misses something, you want to bring that image back up and say, hey, you missed something, and this is what you need to watch for. And yet, if those images are deleted immediately, how is that happening? You did bring up one very interesting issue. You talk about frequent travelers, and of course, one of the issues that TSA is now working on is a trusted traveler program. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have not.
And the trusted traveler program is a free pass around all of the security procedures that are ordinarily at airports. You go in and make an application for this trusted traveler status. You have a background check. You go in for a personal interview. You do this, you do that, and eventually they come back with a determination that, yes, you're a trusted traveler. We'll give you this pass. You can go around security or not. But one of the questions that's being raised is this trusted traveler status is being offered to foreign travelers.
Oh, great.
Including some of those from Saudi Arabia. So my question is, does that not have an influence? I mean, we get back to the profiling issue, but most of the 9/11 attackers came from Saudi Arabia. So why would our government offer a trusted traveler program to Saudi Arabia? The guys that did the 9/11 attack didn't decide on Sunday afternoon that they were going to do the attack on Monday morning. It was a long, extensive, and expensive planning process. So what would stop someone from being a trusted traveler and spending 6 months building a reputation, establishing a trusted traveler status, and then doing something? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
No, I agree with you, and I think it would be ironic. You know, you'd have one guy in front of me in line from Saudi Arabia, and it's like, oh, you know, well, I don't see any problem with getting this approved. You should hear something back immediately, and then I step in line, and like, Mr. Gillard, it says here you're the host of the Tea Party Power Hour. Are you a conservative? You know, I guess that means you're a Christian too, huh? I guess it can't hurt to try. Go ahead and turn it in. I mean, I don't think that as the I can tell you right now, I mean, just with my reputation as a conservative, and I'm sure yours too, we would probably have trouble getting this preferred status, whereas someone from Saudi Arabia would not. I mean, leave it, you know, the government, there's an old saying that a mule is a horse that was designed by a government committee, and I got to tell you, the government finds a way to screw up just about anything, and frankly, the idea of the trusted traveler isn't that bad an idea if the passes only went out to people who are truly trusted travelers. But in a world where everyone is concerned about political correctness and you have to give some of these passes out to people that you know in your heart you shouldn't be giving them to, it actually becomes a liability. So I guess knowing what I know now, thanks to you, I would be against that program in general, even though it might, it should I become a frequent flyer again, be something that I would like to have. I would forego that simply because I would know that it might fall into the hands of the wrong people. But, Bob, never underestimate the U.S. government's ability to screw something up. I mean, it's almost like they take pride on it.
Well, you focused on the crux of the issue there in that regard. If you really want to have a secure airline system, you should let businessmen whose financial fortunes are at stake start doing some of the security. Because if these companies would lose hundreds of millions of dollars every time, and yes, they lose an aircraft when there's a bombing, but the people involved, the compensation paid out to the people is always far less than the aircraft. The compensation should be so draconian that they don't want to allow that to happen, and I guarantee that there would be security on airlines then at that point.
Well, as you said, Israel has a very safe airline, but they're not worried about political correctness the way we are, and I'm sure that's a huge part of it. So what can we expect from Bob Unruh in the future? Do we have more articles coming out on this?
Well, we're watching this. Like I said, the state of Texas has representatives there have introduced that bill. We're watching it to see, you know, how it advances, how far it advances, how quickly. And I'm sure that at some point, if it advances, the federal government is going to start making some contacts and try and influence that as well.
Okay. One last question. I meant to ask you this earlier. You referenced something called the secret order in your piece. What exactly was this secret order, and how is it impacting people's ability to push back on this?
Well, it's a secret, so we don't know. that's the whole issue. The TSA submitted, this was a separate case. This was a case that was brought by a legal advocacy team on behalf of pilots, and I think there were some other airline employees that objected to certain of the pat downs and things like that. And so they were not allowed to do their jobs on occasions when that issue came up. They sued. The TSA submitted to the judge a secret order as part, and it was a sealed document in the court. The judge made his ruling on that secret order, and he dismissed the case brought by the pilots, and the appeals court agreed with him. So the order that is still secret, it is withheld, it is sealed in court documents. The judge made his decision on that document, and the pilots lost their case because of that. So, no, we do not know.
So much for transparency.
Yeah.
That's a whole other show, though, Bob. We've got about a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to say to my audience in closing?
Well, we just appreciate them listening here and occasionally looking at the pages of WND.
Oh, absolutely. Once again, Bob Unruh at WorldNet Daily. Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you very much. Talk to you again.
Take care, my friend.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar.